everybody. Welcome to Senate Finance. It's 9:10 on Tuesday, May 4th. Sorry for the late start. Hung up this morning on phone call. I want to welcome Senator Green, Senator Stevens, Senator Bundy, Senator Dyson, and Senator Olson. Morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Purpose of today's meeting is to consider a whole list of legislation, and we have until 5 minutes until 11 this morning. And then if we need to, which we probably will, we'll reconvene at 1:30 today and go until 4. That hopefully will complete our agenda for the day. So if that conflicts with anyone's schedule, if you'd let me know. Let's see, we're going to start this morning. Senator Terrio's here. He's got a couple bills, Senate Bill 254 and then Senate Bill 395. We'll do those first. We have some out-of-town visitors. Then we'll roll up the list to SR3, bring that back for consideration. And then we'll just go down the list, unless there's some folks that have some time constraints or commissioner shows that we'll want to get that person in ahead. So I think we've published the list. I won't take the time to read down through them. But we'll start this morning with Senate Bill 254, Tourism, and then go to Senate Bill 395. Municipal Land Use Regulation regarding the railroad. With that, Senator Green, anything from your side? Anything else from committee members before we begin our deliberation? If seeing none, then let's begin with Senate Bill 254. Senate Bill 254 is entitled Tourism and Recreation Assessment. It's sponsored by Senator Terrio. A committee substitute for 254 addresses the Alaska Travel Industry Millennium Plan and changes the match requirement. We are dealing with version Z as in Zulu. And let's see, do we have a fiscal note? No fiscal note. I think with that, we're prepared for a presentation. Morning, Senator Terrio. If you would, please, your bill. Senator Bundy?
Z as in Zulu?
I have Z as in Zulu. Is that?
I've got. C is in compromise, or U is in not ready yet.
Well, let's get you Zulu'd up here. So let's stand at ease until we get version Z. That was quick.
And Zubernock.
Okay. Now, Senator Terrio, if you would, please. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The originally, with Senate Bill 254, I was proposing to put the idea on the table, working with the tourism industry on a way that they would be able to assess the industry operations to come up with more money for marketing the state of Alaska as a destination. Unfortunately, we've not been able to keep everybody on board and work out all the potential problems with that piece of legislation. So you do have a proposed CS before you that just drops back to make a modification to the Millennium Plan, what's been called the Millennium Plan, and the required match of the tourism industry for the continuation of the current marketing program that the state has. The industry was not able, has historically not been able to get up to the 60% required match under the Millennium, so this bill, the CS, proposes that we drop back down to the 50% that they've actually been able to generate. I was thankful that the industry, having heard the calls from the legislature over the years to figure out some way of self-funding more of the marketing, they did come forth with an idea earlier this year. However, we've just not been able to keep that package together, so for the time being, the proposal is to set that aside. So with that, I'm available to answer questions if you have any.
Thanks, Senator Terrio. And just for the record, we've been joined by Senator Huffman. And we have been handed a May 4th fiscal note, a zero fiscal note. Senator Green, could I ask you to move to adopt version Z?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would move that we adopt version Z of Senate Bill 254 as our working document.
Is there objection to adopting version Z? Seeing none, it is our working document. Questions of Bill's prime sponsor, Senator Bundy?
Or for you, Mr. Chairman, it's a zero fiscal note because it doesn't increase what we've been spending, but it, is it possible to know what the state share has been on the 50-50 split?
Are you?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I cannot, I can't give you that answer off the top of my head.
Is it $4 million? Oh, Senator Green?
I was just told that it's $2 million for '05.
$2 million for '05, for a total of four. State chair was two and there's been four. All right, thank you.
Okay. Other questions of Senator Terrio? No one here to testify. Will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 254 from committee with individual recommendation and accompanying fiscal note.
Objection to passing.
Just for a question.
Pardon me. Objection by Senator Bundy. Senator Bundy?
Was the original Millennium Plan, did it have a sunset date?
Mr. Chairman, no, it did not.
Thank you.
Okay. Do you remove your objection?
I'll remove my objection.
Further objection to passing Senate Bill 254? Seeing none, passes from committee. Thank you. Let's bring before us Senate Bill 395, having to do with municipal land use regulation. This bill has two sections. It authorizes the Alaska Railroad Corporation to issue up to $500 million in tax-free revenue bonds to pay for extending the rail line to Delta and Fort Greeley. In addition, Senate Bill 395 states that municipal planning, plating, and land use ordinance does not apply to land owned by the railroad. And we have version H is in hotel, and a zero fiscal note. And with that, Senator Terrio, let's see, we have, I think the railroad is here. President Gamble is with us this morning, or chairman, I guess. President. General, I guess that's what we'll just call him general. He's with us this morning to help us with this, but before we do that, we do have some folks in the teleconference network. Mr. Long and Ms. Heidemann have joined us. We'll get to you folks shortly. Senator Terrio, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 395 started out with just Section 1, dealing with trying to deal with a litigation, the outcome of a Supreme Court case on a challenge to the railroad's right to continue to operate a granite quarry in the Klutna area. And so Section 1 tries to deal with the outcome of that court case to make sure that the railroad can continue to operate and would not be subjected to different planning zoning ordinances as the track transitions from one municipality to another. The remaining sections were added on when Mr. Gamble came to us to tell us about an exciting development with regards to the extension of the rail line down to Fort Greeley. Of course, it's been a long desire of many residents of the state of Alaska to extend the rail to meet up with a rail line going into Canada and down to the lower 48. And I see this as an exciting development that takes us a step in that direction. I'll leave it up to Mr. Gamble to explain all the details of his recent meetings in the Washington, D.C. area with regards to the securing of bond funds or securing of money to make this a reality. But what we've done is we've added on authorization for the railroad to issue, as you mentioned, up to $500 million of bonds that would be secured by payments coming from the federal government. That would make the line extension down to Greeley a reality. That would traverse a large section of my district, the Salcha area, taking off from the Eielson area in my district down through the Salcha area. It would cross over the Tanawha River and go across state and federal land until a point down near Delta Junction where it would come back across the river and then into Fort Greeley. It would be used to transport the Stryker Brigade vehicles that we have at Fort Wainwright down to training grounds. It could also be used to transport goods down to Fort Greeley for the support of the missile defense operations down there. I see it as a tremendous step in the right direction for the development of the Delta Greeley area with regards to a gas pipeline. I could envision the Delta area would become a warehousing and stockpiling area for any possible gas pipeline, whether it is to go down the Alaska Highway to Valdez, across the down the Alkin Highway to the lower 48. So I really see a lot of potential upside here for the economic development of the Delta Greeley area. So with that, unless you have specific questions for me, I think turn it over to Mr. Gamble to talk about how, in fact, we intend for the to enter into contracts with the federal government to assure that no assets of the railroad, no assets of the state are put at risk to back up the bonds, that they would be backed up with long-term contracts with the federal government.
Good morning, Mr. Gamble. If you would, any prepared remarks? And it's this bill has two sections, both quite distinct from one another. So if we just, let's concentrate on section two, get the money part out of the way, and then we'll go back to section one. Pat, anything you'd like to share with us?
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Members of the members of the committee, I'm Pat Gamble, the president and CEO of the Alaska Railroad Corporation. With regards to section two and the bonding, I too am quite hopeful that the response that I've received so far is an indicator of the degree to which the interested parties will come together and make this this bonding proposal happen, and happen quickly, so that we can get on with what I think is a pretty exciting project in extending the rail line down to Delta Junction and the ability to support Fort Greeley as well. As Senator Terrio said, because of the interest of two military entities, that is the Department of the Army, with regard to the opportunity that it gives them to use rail to access upwards of 1 million acres of training ground south of Fairbanks right now, which they own, but has only road access. And even at that, they have to cross the Tanana River, which, unless it's frozen in the wintertime thick enough, they can't get armored vehicles across to access this large training area. This rail extension would do that and would provide a spur right into the heart of their training area, where we could offload their vehicles and their troops directly from the base into the training area directly by rail. The active duty Army interest is as far as accessing their training area, but there's about another 35 miles of extension that would take the rail down to Delta Junction and to Fort Greeley, which would also benefit the missile field and the growth in the missile field down in that area. In our concept, what we would propose is to continue that extension down there and then offer freight service and commuter service back and forth from wherever people would like to live, be that Fairbanks or anywhere in between, down to the missile field. The concept there would be that with a card swipe system, military members and contractors who would work down in the area would be able to just simply get on a commuter, a latest state-of-the-art commuter vehicle, and depending on what their schedules are, you know, we would run this several times a day and provide the service back and forth. The advantage in a case like that is you basically have a two-lane road, for those that are familiar, a two-lane road down to Delta Junction, which services both of these entities and the activities that I've just described. That two-lane road in the wintertime, in the middle of winter particularly, can be quite risky for a young wife, for example, with kids that need to go to the dentist or see a specialist, or for some reason have to go into Fairbanks while a spouse is working and they're taking the kids up that road at 50 below in the winter. We know the conditions of that road. We've seen the accident rates on the road and so on and so forth. So the National Guard, who will actually operate the missile field, is interested in giving choices to their members as to where to live and work, can recruit and retain better, in their view, with these options that we're presenting. And so the attractiveness of this to both parties seems to be pretty prevalent. Now, as far as the financing goes, the proposal would be that the Alaska Railroad would use its tax-free bonding authority, something that we've never done in the past, that we would bond for the entire project, which is approximately $500 million all-in cost. That includes the equipment and all the appurtenances that go with the project. This is not a conduit bonding. If the railroad would be, in fact, responsible, have a fiduciary responsibility for the bonds that it issues. The debt service on the bonds, which we have roughly calculated with the help of some experts, would be paid by a combination of the Army and the Department of the Army up out of Fort Wainwright for their share of the interest, and then a portion of the debt service would be paid by the Missile Command and their budget. So there's two separate military budgets involved here. But those budgets would be paying, as the concept goes right now, and this is not yet a proposal, it's a concept. We're still shopping this to see what the level of interest is. But the concept right now would be that there is a level of O&M, operations and maintenance expense, that both of them plan to incur with their current plan of operations. As we substitute this railroad down the line, what we're looking at is the offset between the O&M requirement to service the debt and the O&M that they were previously prepared to pay anyway. And the preliminary indications are that our offer is considerably better than what they were prepared to pay on an annual basis for O&M. And that annual basis then would turn into debt service and relieve the parties of considerable numbers of individual military construction program appropriations. These are annual appropriations. And instead kick it over onto a contract, which would represent a contract with the railroad as part of the transportation, an O&M contract, which would have a level debt service payment throughout the life of the bonds. And that would not go up, and that's very attractive right now to the Missile Command. I have not talked to the Department of the Army, but I have talked to all the entities in the state of Alaska. This is very attractive to them. And I plan to go down to Delta Junction with the Adjutant General on Friday and talk to the citizens and the mayor of Delta Junction about the impact on their city. We'll do that this coming Friday.
Questions of President Gamble? Senator Bundy?
Thank you, Mr. President. When I say President, I guess I can speak in plural here. You've mentioned that this is no expense to the state, but in other issues we've discussed here, it's been stated very clearly that the railroad is an instrument of the state, and so would not indeed the full faith and credit of the state of Alaska be the ultimate guarantor of these bonds? Military plans change, but the state hopefully will always be.
Senator Bundy, I think since it is not conduit funding, you're right on if there were a default, it would be an obligation of the state-owned entity or the state. But I think in contracting with the federal government, we can expect that there's not going to be a default there. And the wording on page 3, it talks about, actually starts on page 2, before issuing the bonds to provide the financing described, the Railroad Corporation shall enter into an agreement with the United States government that will, in the judgment of the corporation, provide sufficient consideration to cover these, the payment of the principal, create a reserve, pay all costs necessary to service and additionally secure the bonds. So certainly would be our intent that it be a contract with the federal government, and we certainly hope that the federal government's not going to default.
Mr. Chairman, they might, but as I indicated, they can change their minds and their plans. And so the thrust of my question is, because even though no matter how remotely it would be, the full faith and credit of Alaska is still the ultimate guarantor, and what impact would that have on our general bond rating, our ability to bond for North Pole High School?
Well, I'll leave that to Mr. Gamble, since he's talked to folks with bonding to answer that. I would hope that there would be no impact. I don't think that the state of Alaska, you can't bind a future legislature, but we know that when the state has entered into contracts, signed contracts, we have a legal obligation to follow through on those. So you're right that the military's plans may change. There could be some kind of a treaty that's entered into that means that we would dismantle or decommission the missile base there at Fort Greely. But I think that if we have signed contracts for the payment of this bond obligation with the federal government, that it could be structured in such a way that they would legally be obligated to continue under contractual arrangement to make those payments.
A second question, if I might.
Before you do that, Back to order. Senator Bundy?
Thought my ears were ringing again. And I know this is conceptual at this point, but just one thing I would like to add to your thinking is the problem that current railroad has with Moose along the its rail line now. One of our most valuable in terms of dollars wildlife resources are the bison in the Delta area, and is there consideration as to what would be done to prevent what happened in the Transcontinental Railroad, not necessarily the cavalierly killing of them, but the problems of train bison accidents?
I think the point is well taken. The good news along that particular route is that it's pretty flat, and the geography allows quite a bit of ability for animals to move. The problem with moose is they get channelized by the deep snow in the woods, and so it kind of funnels them toward the track. Although this year, despite the deep snow, we've had one of the lowest moose kills we've ever had. But clearly, you know, concern for something like that is of great interest to the railroad, and as part of the NEPA process, I'm sure, with a large federal project like this, there's quite an environmental input that is required by the NEPA process, and your concern, Senator Bundy, for wildlife along the way would have to be adequately addressed in the federal process before the approval would be given.
Thank you. I just wanted to keep it on your radar screen.
Okay, thanks, Senator Bundy. Other questions? Okay, I had a couple. I'm very familiar with the terrain between Fort Greeley and Eielson, and I'm trying to figure out how it would ever cost $500 million to build a railroad. So I then go to page 2, line 23 and 24, where it talks about acquisition, construction, improvement, and operation of a rail line and related facilities to Fort Greeley. I'd be interested to know what the scope of this anticipated expenditure is, and I guess I'm thinking about physical scope. You had mentioned something about a bridge over the Tanana. I assume that would be down by the pipeline bridge. So would this money be available to go beyond Greeley? Or where would this not go? Maybe that's the question. What is the scope of this anticipated project?
Mr. Chairman, as I said before, the numbers that we ran on the railroad side, the number I came up with was an all-inclusive number. So it's basically the idea that we have estimated an amount for each one of these particular areas. For example, there's an equipment area. We would have to buy commuter equipment. There's of course the track construction. There are issues like the signals and the siding. You would want to have a siding or two in there along the way. The terminus of the railroad itself would be at Fort Greeley. We would probably be looking within Delta and Fort Greeley at some sort of offload point for passengers. So there might be a small depot that would be constructed at one or both locations. It would connect up in Fairbanks to the depot that we currently have up in Fairbanks. There are probably some land purchase issues that may need to be negotiated, although right now, looking at the maps, the vast majority of the land is either state or federal. That's good news. And then if you look at the financing itself, there's a healthy contingency piece in the financing, as there is a healthy contingency piece in the cost estimate for engineering and construction. The bridge across the Tanana, my understanding right now is in the Army proposal for accessing the range on their own before we made this offer. There is a large bridge that is required to get across the Tanana to provide year-round access. We would take the cost of that bridge into the project, and that's about $45 million. So really, it is all of the above. And including the financial contingencies, that number that you see right there is a package number that is not a conservative number. I mean, it's an all-in number.
So the $45 million bridge is the bridge at Flag Hill?
Flag Hill, that's correct.
And that would contemplate then an extension of the railroad into the Blair Lakes area?
We would build, actually, the line would, the main line would continue on down toward Delta Junction, and we would put an 11-mile extension into the Blair Lakes area so that U.S. Army Striker vehicles, for example, going into the training range would not block the main line. We would actually pull them right off into the range itself and offload them right inside their own range.
In the terminus in Fairbanks, you would contemplate that that is the new terminal?
Well, it would connect to the new terminal. Of course, Fort Wainwright would be a terminus, and the terminal would be a terminus for passenger operations. For freight operations, would go right into the base itself, the post itself at Wainwright.
I think it would help for the file to just have a scope of what the $500 million you think it's going to be used for. I think it would make the file complete. So perhaps we could ask for that. Senator?
Mr. Chairman, as far as any extension beyond Fort Greeley, since on page 2, lines 30 and 31 talk about before issuing the bonds to provide for the financing, they have to enter into an agreement with the United States government for the repayment. Since I would see that the benefit to the United States government would end at Fort Greeley and serving those needs into the training grounds and to service the fort itself. Anything beyond that, I don't think the federal government would be willing to pick up that cost. So the provision here that requires that a contract be entered into makes sure that that the infrastructure that is built is only that which the federal government requires and would keep them from building anything that is not justified.
Well, there was discussion last summer about a foothills railroad across the foothills there in the Alaska Range, which would essentially bypass Fairbanks. So I wouldn't want to think that this 11-mile pipeline, 11-mile rail line, is the camel's nose to start a railroad that's going to bypass Fairbanks. So I've put that on the record and hope that that's not part of this either this year or in years to come until it's proven that that's in the best interest of Fairbanks. But that's a discussion, I'm sure, for another day. Does this lessen our ability to bond for a gas line in case we need that? Is it a half a billion less in case we need to do something with AGPA or something like that?
No, Mr. Chairman. As a matter of fact, as you may know, the Alaska Railroad's tax-free bonding capability is not subject to the cap for the state, and it does not impact the approval that the legislature gave the railroad last year to bond for the full $17 billion amount, if necessary.
Okay. All right. Thank you for clarifying that. Anything else on Section 2? Okay, let's go to Section 1. I think Mr. Long and Ms. Heideman, I think you're online, it looks like, for Section 1. So let's go to that. And who wants to talk about Section 1?
I would. This is Sarah Heideman.
Ma'am, hang on. I'm sorry. Let me have you just stand by for a moment. I was going to ask Senator Terrio or President Gamble if they wanted to speak on Section 1. So either one of you?
Mr. Chairman, I'll go ahead and take the first comment. I'll be as brief and concise as I can to try to get to the core issue, which as I've seen, may be misunderstood. The core issue in this particular Section 1 language refers to a Supreme Court decision. And if I may quote from the decision itself said the following. Because the legislature did not clearly express its intent to exempt the railroad from local zoning laws, we reverse and remand. And that is the decision, as succinct as it can possibly be made. What I'm here for today is to ask this legislature, because it was so named in the court decision as being unclear, to clarify itself for the good of the court and reinstate the status quo that we have had for 18 years since this body approved the bill the first time. The reason the body approved the bill in the first time was because this exemption from planning and zoning is codified in federal law. That federal law made it through the change from the ICC to the Surface Transportation Board intact. And it exists today that basically exempts railroads for interstate commerce purposes from local planning and zoning. It is said by the court that the intent of the legislature when the Railroad Transfer Act occurred was unclear. But I would submit to this body that the committee in the House passed it out. The committee in the Senate passed it out. Both the House and the Senate passed it out. It went into law, and the governor signed it. Now, to me, the intent is pretty clear that all those legislators knew what they were doing, and their intention was made very clear by the fact that they passed the bill and the governor signed the bill, and it went into effect and has been in effect for 18 years. So with all due respect to the majority decision in the court, I agree with the minority decision in the court. It was a 3-2 split decision, hotly contested. And the two minority members were very pointed in their comment that this federal exemption, as mirrored by the state, should prevail for economic purposes, for economic and development purposes. And that as an entity of the state of Alaska, the state should control its own railroad and not leave that control to the purposes of local, municipal, boroughs and municipalities with regard to all their individual planning and zoning needs, that kind of control over a state entity would create havoc in the process of approvals, delays, even if we were to be successful in arbitrating those delays or litigating those delays, as the court has told us to do on a case-by-case basis. The smooth furtherance of state economic development and transportation issues would be impacted severely. So again, to repeat, I'm simply here to ask this same body that passed the law in the first time to note the court's comment that it was not clear to them, that the legislature was not clear in its expression, and to ask this body to make it clear in its expression and reinstate the status quo. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Questions? Senator Terrio, anything to add?
Mr. Gamble, I think, went over the court case and expressed the concern that if the railroad has to go through 13 jurisdictions from Seward up to Fairbanks, and being subject to all these various jurisdictions could cause them problems. And the railroad has been operating for 18 years, being exempt from the local planning and zoning. And we're just asking for the clarification that the court asked for. I know that there is concern from the municipalities, and we do have some suggested language for an amendment from the Fairbanks North Star Borough, our former representative and now Mayor Jim Whitaker, on some language that could be added to Section 1 of the bill that would help to alleviate his concerns. The railroad, since this idea has come up in the bill when it was introduced, has been continuing to contact municipal officials, mayors, assembly members to understand their concerns and try and get them on board with what the potential fix needs to be.
Okay, Senator Bundy, then we'll go to public testimony.
Yeah, thank you. I certainly understand the problems that could occur if each little fiefdom was able to decide whether the railroad was going to go through their territory and what the rules would be. I just wanted to clarify what I thought I heard President Gamble say was that the railroad is a state agency and should be under state control.
The railroad is a state instrumentality, and the feeling of the railroad is that if it's going to be control over an instrumentality of the state, it should be the state that issues the control.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the reasons I think this controversy came up is there was a strong feeling within the people that were affected that the railroad may to a certain degree have been quote-unquote abusing its authority to go ahead and use this to put lay down track and to go ahead and take up a fair amount of real estate against, maybe without the input of people that were being directly affected. And especially when you start dealing with a 500-foot right-of-way, I could see why people would be very concerned about this amount of real estate being taken up. How do you plan on handling those or satisfying those concerns that have been of people that have been calling my office?
Senator, first of all, the normal railroad right-of-way is 200 feet, which was given to the railroad in the transfer. Our construction occurs on railroad property, the fee simple property that was given to the railroad, approximately 36,000 acres. So we're really talking about railroad property here. When we do a construction project on railroad property today, about 80% of all the construction that we do, and that includes fixing roofs, fixing leaks in buildings, I'm talking about all our projects, about 80% of what we spend today includes federal dollars. Federal dollars are given to us either through appropriation or by formula that goes to all other passenger carrying railroads for which we're authorized. Before we can do any work at all on any project using federal dollars, we have to go through quite an extensive community outreach process in order to get input as part of the NEPA process. And so I would say that right off the bat, that 80% already has a considerable public input as required by federal law, and we have to comply with that, and we are audited on our compliance. So for the other 20%, if you subtract out sort of the nuts and bolts and cats and dogs, like fixing a roof down in the shops down in Ship Creek or something, it's not a construction project, we're really talking about a very small number of projects that had the potential of not following under some very specifically set process of public input. And I'm unaware of cases where we've ever laid track or had construction where through that process we have not addressed concerns. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody who has a problem with a particular project is going to prevail. Maybe the railroad does prevail, but certainly the process is a healthy one, and it's codified in federal law. So I would say I would be happy to answer specific cases. If there are some where somebody has made a claim like this, I'd be happy to look at it and address it, but I'm really not aware of that. A lot of it is concern for the future. In other words, what the railroad might do. There's a lot of concern about that. We could do this. We could put a gravel pit in the suburb. We could build a hotel that competes with another hotel. I can address each one of those. If that gravel pit is built by federal money, which it would be, it isn't going to go anywhere near a suburb. I mean, obviously, that isn't going to happen. And we also have a board rule at our railroad board, and that's another entity of checks and balances. And the board rule has said that the railroad is in the railroading business, and it will stay within its core line of business and will not get outside that. For example, we can't go into the hotel business because of the railroad board rule that prevents us from going into outside businesses. So I think we're pretty well covered in that department, but I'd be happy to look at specific cases.
I could just say one more comment, Mr. Campbell. Well, the main example that keeps being cited when people call my office is the railroad laying down track going to the airport, the international airport there in Anchorage. And when you have real estate that's as valuable as that, and you put a fairly sizable area that's taken up for railroad purposes, which may or may not be used as much as other transportation modes, I think that's where I hear the most of the time the example is being pointed toward.
President Gamble, before you answer that question, I need to just excuse myself for about 5 minutes, and I'm going to ask Senator Bundy to come and finish up those questions, and then would you do the folks on teleconference? Senator Stevens is going to take us back to version two, section two, but Senator Green, I think, has some comments on section one. If I could have 5 minutes.
To complete the question? Yes, I did, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Senator Green, I'm sorry.
I thought the question was still open, but if we're done, that's fine with me.
Senator Green.
No, I was just going to say, I have a little different recollection in the way the process went together on the plan to go from the railroad to the airport. And that didn't necessarily, that emphasis didn't come from the railroad at all. It came from the federal government, who came in here with a proposal to get cars off the road and keep cars out of airports. And there's a national interest in Anchorage and surrounding area happened to fall within those parameters, and they provided funding to do that. And I think that came through DOT. Planning of that whole airport site. So I'm not sure we're blaming the right people. I mean, we may want to blame someone, but I don't think that's the one to blame.
I'm trying to find a way to go ahead and answer those people that are calling my office saying, this is what happened, and they keep pointing toward that, and I'm less than from my, not even from Anchorage, obviously.
Further questions? Senator Stevens, before we go to teleconference.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we could go back to Section 2 for a proposed amendment, please.
We have an amendment number 1 that's been distributed.
I'd offer the amendment for object for discussion.
Senator Stevens?
First of all, the amendment actually is page 2, line 31. It begins. And what this does, Mr. Chairman, if I could walk through it and then we can discuss. What it does is page 2, line 31, deletes the word and inserts a binding. So the sentence would read, the Alaska Railroad Corporation shall enter into a binding agreement with the United States government that shall provide sufficient revenue to. That's the way it will read now. That's essentially what the amendment does. What this does, Mr. Chairman, is it deletes some sort of ambiguity in the language that says the United States government will, in the judgment of the corporation, provide sufficient consideration. I think this just clarifies the intent of the language that says the railroad shall enter into a binding agreement with the United States government that shall provide sufficient revenue to retire the principal interest of the bonds as they become due. And I would move the amendment and ask unanimous consent of the four remaining members.
Four logical remaining members. Comments on the amendment from...
General Gamble might have a comment.
I have no comment. I accept the amendment.
Senator Terrio.
Yeah, I understand the senator's desire just to tighten that up, and that I think will help alleviate people's concerns. So.
You've removed your objection.
I'll remove the objection. Thank you.
Any further objection to amendment number 1? Seeing none, we have adopted amendment number 1. Then I'd like to go to testimony on teleconference in Anchorage. We have Sarah Hedman. Ms. Hedman, would you identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony, please?
Yes, thank you. My name is Sarah Hedman. I'm an attorney for the Native Village of Aklutna. And we are here to testify in opposition to Section 1 of this bill. We take no position on Sections 2 through 4. The Supreme Court case that Mr. Gamble mentioned earlier adopts what's called the balancing of the interest test. And it's a test which has been adopted by the vast majority of courts who've addressed the issue of governmental immunity from zoning in the last 30 years. And it was found to, and has been found to, constitute good and enlightened public policy in the area of zoning. I would respectfully disagree with Mr. Gamble that the law, as is found in 4240 of the Alaska statutes, is clear. There was plenty of testimony given back when the laws were enacted that it was not the intent to exempt the railroad from all land use regulation at the local level. The legislature knows how to exempt a state entity from land use regulation if it wants to, and it simply didn't do that. But before I discuss the balancing test that was adopted by the Supreme Court in last month's decision, I would like to mention the federal law and discuss the federal law that Mr. Gamble mentioned. And that's the law known as the Interstate Commerce Commission Termination Act. And what it did is it abolished the ICC, it placed restrictions on state and local regulation of railroads, and it created the Surface Transportation Board. And under that federal law, state and local economic regulation, which would significantly interfere with core rail operations, is prohibited. So in other words, if a state or a municipal government was attempting to prevent a railroad from constructing or operating or discontinuing a rail line, that regulation would already be prohibited by federal law. So here, if someone is saying that a local government could block the extension of the line to Fort Greeley, that is simply not true. Or someone mentioned that local government could regulate the track line from jurisdiction to jurisdiction as it goes through these different communities. Again, that is not the case. The placement of a rail line, the regulation of track from jurisdiction to jurisdiction is a core railroad function. It's regulated only by the Surface Transportation Board, and it's not subject to being blocked by local government. There are two levels of protection that are currently provided to the railroad here. First, you have the federal law, and then you have, after you get past the federal law, then you have the balancing test adopted by the Supreme Court. So, in short, in regard to the extension of the line to Greeley or just the running of the line, the decisions made where to place a line, if to discontinue a line, where to place a train depot, things like that. If a local government was attempting to do any of those things, you wouldn't even reach the balancing test because the federal law would prevent that action. So there is a very finite field within which local governments can regulate in regard to the railroad, and that is what the balancing test applies to. And the test adopted by the Supreme Court last month after standing in front of them for more than 2 years is fair to everyone. It basically would require the railroad to comply with local zoning when compliance would not create a hardship for it, and it immunizes the railroad from local zoning when compliance with it would interfere with their essential operation. Requirements placed upon DOTPF by Title 35 of the statute. DOT operates throughout the entire state. It's generally required to comply with local zoning, but it can be immune from such zoning in appropriate cases. So under the balancing test, the public and local officials get to have input in the rather limited area in which is not prevented or preempted by federal law, but the essential operations of the railroad aren't hindered. The section of Section 1 of this bill would eliminate all public input, all input from local governments, and eliminate any need for the railroad to consider any legitimate public or local interest. And I would add that you don't need governmental immunity from local zoning to run a railroad. Most railroads are owned by private companies, not governmental agencies. There are seven railroads which perform the vast majority of rail freight operations in this country, and all seven are privately owned companies who do not have governmental immunity from local zoning and yet obviously continue to operate. For example, Union Pacific, I believe, is the largest railroad. It operates in 23 states, yet it is privately owned. It is not immune from zoning as a governmental entity, and yet manages to operate. So we think this blanket exemption would fix a system which isn't broken. It's simply not necessary, and at the same time, it would serve to deny the public and local governments from having important and legitimate input. So we would urge that Section 1 of the bill be deleted. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Heideman. Questions of witness? Senator Green?
I was looking at the two sheets of information you provided, and in the last paragraph of one of the sheets, it says it requires the railroad to comply, and it's talking about the lawsuit decision, it requires the railroad to comply with local zoning when it can do so without hardship. It permits the railroad to obtain immunity from local zoning when local zoning would interfere with its operations. Now, would you like to speak to what that means?
Certainly. The balancing test is one that is applied after a entity goes and tries to comply with zoning. So in this case, in case involving Eklutna, the railroad would go to the Local Planning and Zoning Commission and attempt to obtain a conditional use permit. If it was dissatisfied with the result that it obtained from the local officials, then it has the right to seek immunity. And what will happen in that case is that a court would balance the interest. It would look at the public interest that's presented. It would look at the interest that the railroad were trying to promote. It would look at the interference that would be caused by requiring the railroad to comply with local zoning. It would look at all of the interests that were presented, and if the interest presented by the railroad outweighed the other matters presented, then the railroad would be allowed to proceed immune from local zoning. For instance, the main case some 30 years back that first introduced this rule involved the State University in New Jersey. In that case, the university wanted to place multifamily housing in a township where that was not a permitted use. The court looked at what was presented, looked and ascertained that the university's function would be hindered if it was required to comply with the zoning, and therefore found that in that instance, the university was immune from zoning. So those are the things that are reviewed by a court to determine whether it's immune. And so if a railroad in the case sought immunity and could show that it was hindered in its ability to perform an essential state function, then it would be found to be immune from the local zoning regulations in that case.
Can I ask one?
Senator Green?
And is that something then that could go, I assume you go to court to do that, and then could that be appealed by the other side and kind of continue on back up to the Supremes?
Well, in a, it could certainly be appealed by either side. Whether that would hinder the railroad's ability to operate in the instance depends on a number of factors. If, for instance, the railroad prevailed at the Superior Court level, then it would undoubtedly not be hindered in its operations unless the opposing party could, during the appeal process, show that it was A, likely to prevail on the appeal, or B, have the economic means to post a bond.
Thank you.
Senator Green. Other questions of Ms. Heideman? Thank you, ma'am, for your testimony today. I'm sorry I was out. Has Mr. Long testified?
No.
Ron Long and Seward, thank you for joining us. Welcome to finance your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ron Long, and since some of you might recognize my name in connection with the Kanab Peninsula Borough, I need to tell you that my comments are purely my own and not those of the Borough Assembly. We haven't, like most municipalities, haven't had a chance to meet since Section 1 of the bill was introduced. Just a quick comment on Section 2. That's a really exciting project, and I hope we can find a way to make it work. That's great. But back on Section 1, I agree that there's a need for consistency across jurisdictional boundaries for rights of way that probably supersedes, in some cases, the interest of local planning, fighting, and land use regulations. Should be harder, I believe, for the court, for the corporation to make that case on its real estate holdings. The kind of two classes of operations, and they're both essential in one way, in that the real estate holdings support and provide the rest of the state with a good transportation base. But are they essential to moving trains across tracks? I'm not sure. I appreciate the Fairbanks North Star Borough's proposed amendment. I think it's a step in the right direction, but not quite far enough. I think Title 29 pretty appropriately reserves those planning, platting, and land use regulations for the municipalities and provides for some variances. And those variances allow the corporation to make its case and its best interest findings. And, it might be easier to make a case for essential ballast than for a proposed development in Ship Creek, for instance. And that is a for instance, and it's out there in the future, and it hasn't happened, and there isn't a case in history. But that doesn't mean that there's not a legitimate state or local interest in establishing some sort of framework for how it might be developed and having a role in that process. If that variance process that I mentioned doesn't result in a satisfactory outcome, then some sort of resolution process needs to be established, hopefully in collaboration with the local governments. And it needs to distinguish between rights of way and real estate and not be a blanket exemption. The recently adopted Department of Transportation public facilities right-of-way exemption is probably a good model. There's some of the discrepancy or seeming incongruities between federal and state law or federal and local land use might be that feds are looking at railroads not as our unique Alaska model that involves several different components. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ron. Questions of Mr. Long? Thank you, sir, for joining us. Anyone else on the teleconference network for Senate Bill 395? Okay, thanks for joining us, folks. Back to the table. Any other questions on Section 1? President Gamble, this has created a bit of a problem, at least in my mind, and I've tried to visit with my borough assembly people, and the mayor here, I see yesterday, sent us this piece here. If we brought back a committee substitute that just deleted Section 1, what effect would that have on the railroad, expecting that a bill such as this, Section 1, would come back in January for a full committee review?
Mr. Chairman, essentially we would have to, we would be, and we are as of the 12th of March, under the guidance of the court, which as Ms. Heideman said correctly, unless there's a redress of the language, then they gave us guidance. And that guidance was, as she pointed out, the idea is that we would, during this interim period, for whatever project, including, and it's unclear right now, that there was no retroactivity specified by the court. I mean, it would appear that 12 March was sort of a new start date, but I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know the real position there. But from this point forward, whatever projects we have in the mill that would require a permit, following the court's directions, we would go after a permit for planning and zoning, conditional use or whatever. And then if we disagree with that, then, as the court said, we must litigate. And then in the litigation, the test is applied. And this has to be done on a case-by-case basis. So from the railroad's position, we're looking at the entirety of the line and whatever projects would come up during this period of time. The idea that it would be litigated is interesting because the one thing we haven't discussed is the fact that the court also said that it's not just the municipalities and the boroughs that have the right to challenge an agreement or a disagreement between the municipality, a borough, or the railroad. Even if we agree and get the permit and actually start a project, the court has also opened the door for any individual or any private group to also challenge that permit. And it must be litigated. And then in that litigation, the test must be applied. And then, of course, there's the appeals process. Well, as we know, for individuals or private groups, the idea of tying something up or going to appeal is a tactic for a group that is against the process. I mean, it in and of itself is a tactic. So the question is, you know, does the state go forward with a particular project that, let's say, the railroad and the municipality are pretty keen to have, or do we not? Because we are in this process dictated by the court where we've got to go case by case, appeal by appeal. And as you know, that process is a very lengthy process. Mm-hmm. Just the permit process itself can sometimes take weeks or even go into a few months. So that would be the situation that we would be under. I can't get specific about particular projects because I don't know the future here, but that would be the conditions.
And I'm very sympathetic to the railroad's problem. I mean, we just need to look at what's happened in the last 2 weeks at Pogo to underline exactly what you said about tactics. And I wouldn't want that type of a situation to occur with our railroad. But at the same time, I'm sensitive to the fact that the bill says do not apply, and our municipality, our assembly, has not had a chance really to digest what that means. So I'm trying to balance the protection of the railroad against the responsibility of our assemblies to have planning and platting, and not only for this year, but I think what this bill means 50 years from now, and that really concerns me until they have a sense of what we're doing and have some way to implement. Now, Mayor Whitaker's proposed language here, paragraph C, he goes on to say that, well, this is acceptable language, but the railroad disagrees, therefore we should have some sort of, he suggests, a subcommittee or muni task force. What I think that's really saying is that we need more time to at least talk about this. I know that at Mat-Su Assembly, and Senator Green can help a little bit with this, they're concerned. We've gotten a couple of letters in the last couple of days as this has surfaced. So my problem here is this, what I consider to be very far-reaching legislation, really isn't going to have its proper due in this body so that the local assemblies, local people can ring in on what's trying to be done here. That's not to expose the railroad to litigation that is going to slow down their expansion. But I'm wondering, I guess, what 8 months means if we took Section 1 aside and brought it back next year. And that, Senator Green, would you help us with Matt, what you're hearing from Matt?
Okay. One of the things I had kind of a conversation, and there was, there's two questions, and one might better be addressed to a lawyer. Do you, by responding to the decision of the court and then begin going through a more rigorous permit process, conditional use or whatever, do precedent setting that from which you cannot reverse, even if the court case is overturned or it's appealed or new information is taken to them. The other would be, one of the things I've kind of heard that the concern, some of it is between operations of the railroad and the real estate of the railroad. And is there any logical separation between, because I don't think anyone wants to have any say over the current track, when you run, what you do, how you use railroad track land, how you repair it, or whatever. I don't think that's the issue. And if I'm hearing from people incorrectly, then I stand to be corrected, but versus the use of real estate holdings of the railroad. Does that make any sense, or is there a way to divide out those two where it's a two-track solution, and then in the meantime come back and work further on it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Green, that's a real interesting question. Where are the boundary lines in this? You're exactly right in that in the short time that we've been exposed to the pushback on this particular piece of legislature, it's clear that the vast majority of that pushback has been in the land use area, not in the operational area. I completely agree with you on that. And when you get to the business of trying to figure out where the boundary lines are, you get into some very controversial or subjective areas. I'll give you one example that joins operations and land use, and trying to separate the two is could be somewhat difficult in terms of, well, do we have to challenge this? Do we have to take it to court and so on? We're building a building in Ship Creek. It's on railroad property. It's not a municipal building. And, of course, we have to comply with all the codes and all that sort of thing already. We do that. But planning and zoning says there's a certain landscaping scheme that must go around certain kinds of buildings for the municipality of Anchorage. The planning and zoning people have highlighted the fact that the landscaping looks fine except for the trees that have to be planted. And they said you have not planted trees in one certain area where you have to have trees according to the code. Our comeback was, well, there's an observation platform there that is intended to look up and down the rail yard to actually see physically what's going on in the rail yard, and if you plant trees there, it takes away the operational capability of the people in there to see what's going on. And the debate began as to whether or not that overrides the planning and zoning requirement to plant the trees, because in 10 years those trees will grow up and block the view. Now that's a pretty petty issue, and clearly one that you would think right away would be overcome by a waiver or whatever. Well, when we asked about that, the first answer we got back is there is no waiver, no provision for waiver. Well, of course, any rule is waiverable, but you see, when you multiply the ambiguity there times all these potential cases out in front of us, you understand why the federal exemption, why the original legislative intent of this body back at transfer was to not have to go through that on a case-by-case basis for everything in the future. And therefore, we had the original exemption, and as I argued before, I think their intent was pretty clear at the time.
Secretary.
Thank you. And the example that Mr. Campbell just gave talks about a development of a piece of property that would be used for the operation of the railroad. If you look on lines, page 1, lines 11 and 12, it talks about that land that is leased by the railroad, because we know that they have substantial land holdings that they actually put into use. They lease it out, and that's part of the revenue base. But when they do that, leased to another person by the corporation, and the corporation has not retained a right to use the land during the terms of the lease, that would still be subject to the local zoning. So if it's not for railroad use, they just put it out, they rent, lease it long-term to a hotel, an RV park, or something like that, that by the terms of the lease, the railroad no longer has use of that land, that would be subject to the planning and zoning.
And is today, by the way.
And Mr. Chairman, with regards to the letter from Mayor Whitaker, I know my conversations with Mr. Gamble indicated that they are agreeable to the addition of this language, a new sub C, to the bill, despite the fact that, you know, given that the last sentence says, given the railroad disagrees, they do not disagree with this language. So
I think he's referring to something else there. Mr. Chairman, he's not referring to the railroad's agreement with his amendment, because we do agree, and I've told him that. So I think this is taken out of context, really.
Okay. We'll clarify that. Letter discussion on section number one. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we could do something that the chairman suggested, and that's to go ahead and reconsider section one in the next 8 months from now or so, well, how many projects, how many significant projects would be impacted in a negative manner by that, by doing that?
Senator, I can't give you a number, but I can certainly get that. I don't have that information at my fingertips right now. We have approximately 113 projects on the books right now. I would have to look and see municipality by borough all the way down at what stage those projects were in and which ones would be affected by this immediately, whereas they weren't before. I can get that information
for you, Mr. Chairman.
Here's where I think we are. The reason we're struggling with Section 1 is only because of time. If we had a month or 2 months ahead of us, we would each go to our assemblies and we would say, so Anchorage, what do you think? And Metsu, what do you think? And Fairbanks and Seward, what do you think about this proposal? And they'd come back and they'd tell us what we think and we'd craft out some legislation. But we're in this press of time that has made me very uncomfortable that my assembly, I'm not sure they know where they are. And by the letter, I'm not sure my mayor knows where he's at. So we can talk some more about this today, but I'm suggesting we set this aside for the moment and bring back the CS tomorrow. And considering removing Section 1 and discussing that very point. And with that, Senator Green tomorrow will have a report from Metsu. They're at least going to be able to meet formally. And I think Kenai is also going to meet tonight. Someone told me that. I don't know who did. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I appreciate your concern, and I have some subsidiary ones. I would encourage you to think about a way that we could maybe leave Section 1 in effect for a narrow list of projects, you know, that are high priority or something like that, so that none of these happen, you know.
We want to protect the railroad until we can do due consideration in this body next year. Maybe it's a sunset of some sort. Maybe it's a piece by piece. Does that help a little bit, Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, I think with the adoption of the suggested language of Mayor Whitaker, if that were put in, and if it would increase the committee's comfort level, you just used the words sunset. You could take care of the problem for a period of time and have a sunset on it. So through the interim, all this, the people that have dog in this fight would be able to get together, knowing that this would come out of the statutes next year. And if they want to see something else, some alternative language, they'd be able to hammer that out and bring that to the legislature next year. But between now and then, we would not throw all the projects, up in the air and make them very uncertain on whether they're going to have to go through this possibly protracted legal problem.
Let's work towards that. And President Gamble, who would we work with on your staff to bring that back for us tomorrow? Wendy?
Wendy and I will both be here.
Okay, so let's work on that to try to just bridge this press of time that we're under, and so that you're protected, you get what you need. At the same time, we give time for our assemblies to ring in and know exactly, because I'll the risk of repeating myself, I don't worry about this sentence tomorrow. I worry about this sentence 50 years from now. That's what bothers me, because it's very explicit. So is there anything else? Is that a direction that the committee would like us to go? Okay, thank you. Secretary, thank you for being here. President Gamble, thanks for your help with this. And we'll set it aside until tomorrow. And we'll also clarify the letter. Okay, let's come back to our schedule. We'll just march right down the schedule here. We have till 5 to 11 today. We'll start with Senate Resolution 3, commemorating Frank Ferguson, sponsored by Senator Olson. This is its second hearing. We are dealing with version A as an alpha.
amended.
Senator Olson, where did we leave this last? We had some concerns about how the, where the plaque was going to be and how names are going to go on it. Help us out here.
Mr. Chairman, with all due respect to those people that are here at the committee meeting, I feel like after going through the last bill that this particular resolution, you know, at least lightens the burden and makes it a little easier for us to go ahead and look at something without the long range, except for posthumous considerations. I introduced Senate Resolution 3 to honor senators who are specially recognized by the Alaska State Legislature for their contribution to the Alaska State, to the state of Alaska. This commemorative plaque would be placed in the Capitol building. In the past, distinguished legislators have been recognized by having buildings and rooms named in their honor, all the way back to 1979 when William Belts, John Butrovich, had rooms named after them. Later on, we have the galleries down at the Senate named after Terry Miller and Bob Ziegler. And then, of course, the building was named after Terry Miller up the way, and then the gallery was renamed after Cliff Grohl. We have those type of ways to go and remember people. And obviously, we're running out of rooms and galleries and those type of things. And so I went ahead and proposed this amendment to have a plaque put up for those distinguished legislators, especially senators that have served here. And I present it to you today. I have a copy, and I'm assuming that if you do a copy of the plaque that you are specifically looking at, and that's the bottom, and I've got other extra copies if you'd like. And I've got, after our discussion last time, I have several amendments to propose to answer some of the questions and to fine-tune where the plaque would be, how do you get on the plaque, and answer some of the questions that were specifically brought up, if you'd like.
Thanks, Senator Olson. Just to bring us up to date, so if we go to page 2, line 24, at the last meeting, we don't have a committee substitute, but that line now reads, established at a place inside the Capitol building for the listing of. So that gets us current. Place. Is that right, Senator Green?
At a prominent place inside the Capitol building. Is it?
Oh, excuse me. That's right. I read that wrong. Yes, at a prominent place inside the Capitol building. Mm-hmm. I have an amendment, but Senator Olson, why don't you offer yours, and yours may duplicate mine.
Actually, I move amendment number 1 to Mr. President.
And has it been distributed?
Yes, it has, hasn't it? Mm-hmm.
I thought we adopted it last time.
1 and 2?
Okay. 1 and 2, okay.
Okay, so this, the amendment that Senator Olson is proposing would be amendment number 3?
We have another amendment.
You adopted 1 and 2 last time?
You have new amendments today?
No, I don't.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood. I thought you said you had. I'm sorry. I misunderstood. I thought you said you had amendments today. Okay.
Can you just take a break for the
sir? Sanity. Okay, thanks. Confusion on my part. All right. So we do have amendment 1 and 2. That was what we read into the record here just a moment ago. Okay. I have amendment number 3, which I'll bet hasn't been distributed yet. Okay. Let's try a conceptual amendment number 3, which I would move, and it reads as follows. Go to page 2, line 25. And that sentence reads, senators who are specially recognized by the Alaska State Senate, it would now say the word by would be followed with the two words, resolution of. So the sentence would read, specially recognized by resolution of the Alaska State Senate in our, I would move that conceptual amendment number 3 and ask for objection.
You want me to object?
Yes.
I object.
Would you like explanation?
I would. If you'd just direct me to the line, I'd be even happier.
Line number, page 2, line 25.
Okay.
After the word by, insert resolution of. Our uniform rules under Rule 49 allow for a simple resolution by one House or the other, and it's called a House resolution or a Senate resolution, and it's considered only in one body, and it's called a simple resolution, and that's what this amendment would address.
Okay.
Senator Olson, would that be acceptable to you?
It's more than acceptable, Mr. Chairman, and that's, I certainly appreciate you presenting the amendment.
Okay. On amendment number three, is there further discussion? Is there, would you remove your objection?
I remove my objection.
Okay. There's no further objection. Amendment number three is adopted. Brings the bill back before us as amended. Senator Olson?
I'd like one more conceptual amendment, if I could, and one of the considerations on the same sentence there, page 2, line 25, where it says senators who are specifically recognized, and after that, the consideration of putting in the words posthumously, which obviously means that there's a special category you got to be under before you could be added to the list.
Very special category. Okay, and where would you insert that? Wordsmith, Senator Green, help us.
Posthumously would be right after recognized.
Mm-hmm. Recognized posthumous.
Posthumously.
By resolution of
whatever that word is.
Can you nominate a few for this?
Okay. Amendment number four, conceptual amendment, inserts the word posthumous.
Posthumous.
What is it?
Posthumous.
Posthumous. Posthumous. Thank you.
Yeah. This is actually inspired by the senator that sits across from me.
And everybody understand amendment number four. Don't ask me to repeat it.
I do.
We don't use those words in the potato chip business. Is there objection to amendment number four? All right. Now it brings the resolution back before us as amended. Senator Olson.
I move this resolution from committee.
With individual recommendations?
With individual recommendations.
And attached fiscal notes?
And attached fiscal.
All right. As amended.
As amended.
All right. Well done. Well done, Senator Olson. Is there objection to passing SR3 from committee? Seeing none, SR3 passes from committee. Thank you for your help. Sheila, thanks for your help on that, too. Okay.
The price of admission gets high. Too high for me.
Let's come to Senate Bill 224. Who's here to help us, Richard? Senate Bill 224 lowers the DWI to minors for minors. Sponsored by Senator Cowdery, it makes it a criminal offense to drive under the influence if the person is under 21 years of age and has a blood alcohol content of 0.02 or more. We have an indeterminate fiscal note. We have a number of fiscal notes. In fact, we're up through 10. We're working with the State Affairs version, and it's version B as in Bravo. And with that, I think, we have Barb Rink is on the line from Alaska Public Defenders. She's there to answer questions. Good morning, Barb. Thanks for joining us.
Mr. Chairman.
Good morning. And with that, let's go to the bill's prime sponsor, Mr. Schmitz, if you would, to present the bill.
Yeah, thank you. I didn't bring in the packet, there's just a few things, the fiscal notes, the bill itself, and a sponsor statement. I think we all know the social ills of DWIs and the specific infraction that we're looking at here is what they call MOVAX, which is when you're a minor. In other words, we know you're not allowed to drink when you're under 21. So there's kind of a gap there where people who are drinking, but they're not at the 0.8. If you get a DWI, you get a DWI. But if you've consumed alcohol within the previous 24 hours and you're under 21 and you drive, that's sort of a separate thing. Now, we actually changed the bill in the last committee to try to get away from some of the controversy, and that was it's no longer a misdemeanor B. It's just back to being an infraction. But what it does is that it puts in place a mandatory fine and mandatory community service. At three separate levels. The first time you get a $500 fine, and second time it's a $1,000 fine, and the third time it's a $1,500 fine, and beyond. So this way it keeps it within magistrates, it can move through the system quicker, and then it gets away from the problem of there's federal regulations that don't allow you to put minors in jail or lock them up under what they call a status offense, which is a kind of offense that if you do it when you're on one day it's illegal, and if you do it the next day after your birthday, it's legal. So Cindy Cashin from the Mothers Against Drunk Driving is here, and I would just ask her if she wanted to come up and speak about the bill. She knows it really well and knows some of the things. It's just simplified to just do those three things. It has three basic sections, but there's no longer any kind of a criminal it doesn't go into the into that area of being a misdemeanor.
Okay, Commissioner, Ms. Cashin is signed up, as is Mr. Smith, and we're going to get to them in just one moment. Questions of the bill's prime sponsor? Richard, is the sponsor statement drafted to version B?
Yes.
So the sponsor statement is current?
Yes.
Okay. Other questions of the bill's prime sponsor? Seeing none, Richard, why don't you stay there? And let's ask Don Smith.
Excuse me, I'm going to correct that. No.
Correct that, no. So it's not current?
Not the one I'm looking at, but no, it's not. The misdemeanor part has been taken out, so.
Okay, so if you'd make that current.
I can do that, yeah.
For the floor. Okay, let's go ladies first. Actually, Cindy, if you'd join us first. And Richard, you can stay right there. Hi, Cindy. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Cindy Cashin. I'm the executive director of the MAD Juneau chapter. I'm here today on behalf of the four MAD Alaska chapters, the MAD Anchorage chapter, the MAD Fairbanks chapter, the MAD Juneau chapter, and the MAD Matsu chapter. Ordinarily, we would not be supporting this bill because it takes misdemeanors out. But realistically, we support this bill, and in fact, we went to the sponsor and asked if this change be made where all MOVACs remained an infraction instead of a misdemeanor, and that the fine be imposed and community work service relating to the education or prevention or treatment of the misuse of alcohol. And the reason being is because what's happening and what has been happening in Alaska is that teenagers get MOVACs, minors operating vehicles after consuming. It creates a bottleneck in the DA's office because unfortunately, as law enforcement is cracking down on drunk driving, they're also catching the teenagers that are drunk driving. And their caseload builds up. And what the teenagers have figured out, and it doesn't take long for word to spread, and this is from our observance from court monitoring across the state, is that the teenagers will hold off on the hearings or they'll hire a lawyer, and then what happens is it's either pled down or it's unfortunately dismissed. And then the kids get nothing out of it. And when they keep postponing the sooner they're processed, the better, because the sooner they're processed after they commit the crime, the more contrite they are, the more aware they are that they did screw up and that they need to figure out what's the right thing to do in the future. And when you have 3, 4, 5 months go by, after a while, it's a joke. And literally it is. I've seen these teenagers walk out of the courtroom laughing. They think it's funny. And it is a joke. It has become a joke. When you get $400 after your second MOVAC, and in reality, that's the second time a teenager's been caught drunk driving, $400 is not enough. That's not going to stop them. They're going to continue to drink and drive. Why should they stop? What's to prevent them? This bill will prevent a lot of them because it increases the fine substantially so that if they don't care, mom and dad certainly will care. It also adds in the community work service, and right now community work service has been dropped among most of the MOVAC citations because the judges just don't think it's around, they don't think it's possible, and when you require the teenager to find the community work service, you're making them think about what nonprofit agencies are out there that deal with them. You're requiring them to pick up the phone and deal with their consequence, they're having to play an active part in it. We have kids that have community work service come in and work with MAD, and it's, I don't know if it makes a change, but I think it does. I've had youth talk to us about it afterwards, and they're glad that they worked with us, and when they leave, we don't see them again. Now, I can't say that's going to happen to everyone, but I believe that with this bill, it will make a difference. It'll push them through the system faster, and it'll get them in connection with us quicker. And we really hope that you will pass this bill out so that we can start dealing with these teenagers like they need to be dealt with.
Questions of Ms. Cashin? Senator Bundy?
Ms. Cashin, I was just wondering, if there's been any calculation as to whether the increased fines would generate enough money that would address the fiscal note from public defender.
More time, Senator Bundy.
If the increased fine would have an impact on the fiscal note from the public defender.
Okay.
Is there, I know that money doesn't go directly there, but does it, rising tide, raise all these votes?
Good question.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, what's happened currently is that they have the right to a lawyer. Nothing's going to change. They're still going to have that right. The kids, the lawyer is not, or the, excuse me, the judge is not going to be more apt to put off the sentencing or the hearing because there's no need for it. A magistrate can do it. It's going to lessen the workload. Nothing's really going to change in the public defender agency's office. They might say it will, but we do not believe it will. And this is from, again, us court monitoring the various courts in Alaska.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
And Cindy can stay there. Ms. Brink, it says here that this law, if passed, would require an addition of one person?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. This is Barbara Brink with the Alaska Public Defender Agency. We're relying on the numbers that were supplied by the Department of Motor Vehicles, calculating how many underage minors that they process for administrative driver's license revocations who are not currently charged with operating a motor vehicle after consuming. The problem, Mr. Chairman, that we have to remember is that, and I respectfully disagree with Mr. Schmidt and Ms. Cashin, this is a criminal offense. Designating it as an infraction is not going to prevent the need for jury trials, and it's also not going to prevent the need for appointed counsel. The Alaska Board of Appeals has held repeatedly that custodial inpatient treatment or community work service are penalties that trigger the right to counsel. So this will require attorneys, and frankly, these cases are going to be viewed as misdemeanors. I don't think that magistrates will be able to handle these. I think that they will have to be assigned to district court judges. The question, of course, is the difficulty of predicting the increase in caseload, and as I said, we're simply relying on the numbers provided by the Department of Motor Vehicles for how many more people could be charged. And I think that the reason we're increasing the penalties is that we want to use this in order to decrease the number of kids who are consuming alcohol while driving. We should remember, though, that we're not talking about drunk driving. Drunk driving kids, any kid with over 0.08 is already charged and prosecuted for driving under the influence. What we're talking about here is kids who've consumed any amount of alcohol and are operating a motor vehicle. So, you know, I don't have anything against this bill. I just think that we need to take a realistic appraisal of what this is going to do. A couple of years ago when the legislature was considering minor consuming and they wanted to do the same thing, they increased the penalties to provide for mandatory fines and mandatory community work service. And we were all trying to predict at that time how many more cases we were going to have. I thought we were going to have a lot, but my fiscal note at that time was reduced from four attorneys to half an attorney. And I can tell you that in 2001, the Public Defender Agency was appointed to 58 minor consuming cases. And in fiscal year 03, we were appointed to 892. So I think this might be effective statute to use to stop underage drinking, but you know, justice comes at a price. And one of those prices is that appointed counsel will be necessary in these cases. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Barb, for your input. Richard, short response?
Cindy, you'd like to respond?
Briefly, Cindy, if you would. We need to get some stuff done here before 5 to 11. Okay. Cindy?
This doesn't change the amount of numbers that are already going through. It's not going to increase the number of kids that are already getting MOVAX. It's going to get them through the system faster. It's going to make it easier.
Okay, let's see. Cindy, thanks for your testimony. And Senator Dyson says, thanks for what you do. Is that how you say that? Right. Okay, Don, can you join us?
For the record, my name is Don Smith. I'm administrator of the Alaska Highway Safety Office, and for the record, we'd just like to go on record as being in support of this bill.
That's it. Short and sweet. Thank you, Don, for coming and joining us this morning. Okay, let's see. Other discussion on Senate Bill 224. No one else on teleconference line, and nobody else in the room. Will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate Bill 224, version B, out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
There's objection to passing Senate Bill 224 from committee. Seeing none, it passes from committee. Thank you, Richard, for your help. We've got some folks there from the Coast Guard are with us, and we want to make sure we get them in because they've been patiently waiting. So let's bring before us House Bill 93, sponsored by Representative Wyrock. House Bill 93 extends the date of Alaska Boating Safety Act from 2005 to 2010, and in addition, the requirement for registration of non-powered vessels has been removed. We have a fiscal note, and we're dealing with version U, which is a transportation version. We have online to answer questions Jeff Johnson from the State of Alaska Office of Boating Safety. And with that, I think we're ready for a bill presentation. Linda, good morning. If you would introduce yourself and present House Bill 93.
Thank you. I'm Linda Sylvester, staff to Representative Bruce Wyrock, the sponsor of HB 93. This is a continuation of the work that was that Representative Bill Hudson started. The Boating Registration Program passed the legislature in the year 2000. There was a sunset applied to it. The concern at that time was that the federal funds that pay for the program might not be continuous. The funds are in place, and there's no indication that the funds will ever be stopped. The funds for the federal program come from the Wallop-Rowe Trust Fund, and we do have an extension on the sunset. Originally, the bill did not have just completely eliminated the sunset. There was controversy in the House Transportation Committee. It seems the original language of the bill, which was just a continuation of a program, had a lot of opposition because of the requirement to register non-powered boats. And the agreement in the House Transportation Committee was that these boats would be exempted. There's just a sense around the state that it was just egregious. It didn't make sense for people to have to register, put a sticker on their vessel, which they keep under their bed in some cases, or sometimes they use them, sometimes they don't, and we just did a balance and picked the group that we would make least unhappy, and this also has got the added